one person exonerated for every 9 executions is a vast amount of people. We've had hundreds of others wrongfully convicted, but not fully exonerated. And so that in and of itself was enough for me. You know, if even one person is wrongfully killed by the government, I'm not sure this is a system I can any longer stand by.
You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. I'm very grateful today to have our first repeat guest on the program. We've been doing this for about 3 months, and you haven't had the chance to listen to anybody a second time. But today, again with me today for a special edition, is Hannah Cox. Hannah is my colleague. She's a fellow at the Foundation for Economic Education. And in her day job, she runs Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty. Hannah, thanks so much for coming back.
Thanks for having me back, Brad.
So we're here today to record a special conversation because on December 10th, Brandon Bernard became the 9th person executed by the federal government in 2020. And this is just the latest in a spree of executions carried out by the Trump administration, with this year actually the first time in 17 years that federal executions have been carried out at all. So Hannah, just to start, can you explain why you as a conservative think that conservatives should oppose the death penalty?
Sure. And, you know, this wasn't a view I always held. I, like many conservatives, grew up supporting the death penalty. But the reasons I supported it were reasons that were based around assumptions. I had never actually been around the system. I quite frankly knew nothing about what I was talking about. And so I thought that the death penalty saved money. I thought that it was something that victims' family members needed and wanted, and that if I were in their shoes, I would need and want it. I thought it was something that actually was a deterrent to crime that made us more safe. And so I had all these assumptions around it. And it was while I was doing some pro bono lobbying for the National Alliance on Mental Illness a number of years ago that I was first asked to work around a death penalty issue. They were seeking an exclusion from the death penalty for people with severe mental illness, which many people think we already do. We do not. We execute many people with very severe mental illnesses. And at the time I said, no, I'm sorry, I can't work on that bill for you. I'm not aligned with you on that. And they said, you want to have the death penalty for people with mental illness? And I was like, I don't see why not. I mean, I was just so far into my groupthink on this issue, I could not fathom that there were reasons that would make me change my mind. But they presented me with some data, with some statistics and studies, and they said, well, you just read some of this and look into it. I don't think you maybe know exactly how this operates. And so I did that. I realized that I had never actually taken the time to research the issue. I just kind of had an emotional stance on it. And so when I started looking into it, what I found was highly disturbing to me, but also not surprising. As someone who believes in a limited government, I have that stance because I know government is prone to corruption and to error and to inefficiency. And so I don't know why for so long I exempted the Justice Department from that stance. But I had. And as I started digging into the system and the system at large within the justice system, you know, I found that not only did we have a large number of innocence issues within the system, but that it wasn't the system itself catching those innocence issues. It was actually usually pro bono groups coming in and working like the Innocence Project. And, you know, it was just kind of a luck of the draw. If you were someone who was wrongfully convicted, if you happened to catch the attention and they had the resources for your case and you got one of these outside groups so that you had adequate counsel, maybe your case would work its way out. And if not, you might be executed. And that actually happened a lot more than I thought. There's been one person exonerated for every 9 executions in this country. And that's kind of jargon. When we say exoneration, that's a pretty high bar in the legal system. So you can have your case overturned. It can be thrown out. You might take an Alford plea. There's all kinds of ways that a wrongful conviction can work itself out of the system. But to be exonerated is a separate higher bar. You usually have to show that DNA matches somebody else. And it really conclusively proves that you were not the person who did it. So one person exonerated for every 9 executions is a vast amount of people. We've had hundreds of others wrongfully convicted, but not fully exonerated. And so that in and of itself was enough for me. You know, if even one person is wrongfully killed by the government, I'm not sure this is a system I can any longer stand by. But it got worse as I dug in. I found out that the death penalty actually didn't save us money. The exact opposite. It was actually the most expensive part of the criminal justice system on a per offender basis. And contrary to popular belief, those costs don't come from the length of time that it takes to carry out the execution, the appellate process. They actually mostly come from the trial because it's so much more comprehensive and lengthy. And so that's more money that we're paying. That's more hours worked for public defenders, for prosecutors, for judges, for law enforcement, for lab testing, for testimony, on and on and on. It escalates quite quickly to make it about 10 times more expensive to have a death penalty case than life in prison without parole. So as a fiscal conservative, that was problematic. And when you couple that with the fact that it's not a deterrent to crime whatsoever, to me, I began to see this as an opportunity cost. It was something that actually made us less safe because we weren't spending those dollars on things that actually could prevent crime or on solving more crime in the first place, which is the true deterrent.
Well, let's talk about this because you mentioned the one for every 9 exonerations for every 9 executions. And I find that statistic very jarring, right? Because in almost no walk of life would we accept a 1 for 9 failure rate. No one would ever get on a plane if one plane crashed for every 9 that successfully landed. Nobody would ever take a medication if 1 in 9 people or 1 for 9 people died that took it. So that is, it's a pretty jarring rate of injustice. And like you said, it's not the only one, but I kind of want to separate the kind of debate into 2 different buckets. One is the practicality of it, and another one is kind of the abstract principle and morality of it. So I have come along, like you, to the anti-death penalty position, but for me, it is really basically exclusively because of the cost, of the inefficiency, and of the real-world likelihood that, consistent with my beliefs and confirmed by data and evidence, government messes things up. And when it comes to irreversible executions, we can't accept the government's rather high rate of error and incompetence and inefficiency. But I actually have no objection, really, to the principle that the government could execute or take the life of a murderer or of a child rapist or of someone else that's guilty of these heinous crimes. It's really just the practicality for me. But so if you were to separate the two, which I know we can't in the real world, do you still think there's a moral case that we should never accept capital punishment, even aside from the whole practical argument?
I'll say that I do now, but I started off where you are, and it took years for me to get there. It really is more of a personal stance, right? Like, my public stance on the policy is based on, does it work? Is it efficient? Does it conserve our dollars? Does it protect human life? And that's how I approach almost all matters of public policy. And the death penalty fails unilaterally when those questions are asked. There's absolutely no excuse for us to continue doubling down on it. It simply does not work, and there's too high of a cost to continue trying to make it work. And there are so many better alternatives that we could be investing in that actually would produce better results. So that's where I stood for many, many years. And I remember oftentimes in the movement, a lot of my colleagues would be very emotional over it and would feel very stirred up around executions. And I was just feeling like, is there something wrong with me? Because I just don't feel this, right? Like, I don't feel the emotions that so many other people in this movement feel. I don't really have a problem with the death penalty in theory. It's just in practice. But I think what changed that for me was the first time I met Ray Krohn, who was the 100th person exonerated from death row. And Ray is great. He lives in Tennessee now. He's a Trump supporter. He'd win a fist fight every time. He's a vet. he's great. But he was wrongfully convicted for murdering and raping a woman in Arizona when he was in his young 20s. Per usual, he was a poor kid, didn't have money for a good defense. And he was wrongfully convicted on bad forensics, which we see very often. 45% of wrongful convictions have involved the misapplication of forensic science. He was convicted on bite mark evidence, which is now considered absolute junk science. You can't even introduce it in a court anymore, but it convicted a lot of people. And when that happens, we don't go back through and comb through those cases and say, oh, you get out now because you were convicted on this bad science. But he was able to prove his innocence. He was able to get out. He's been exonerated. But hearing him talk about his experience, something kind of clicked in me when I met him, where the human aspect of it really hit, that this was somebody we could have killed. And I can't really totally articulate what that's like. But on top of that, from that point on, you know, I then went on to meet many murder victims' family members who were opposed to the death penalty. We worked with hundreds of them across this country, and hearing their personal stories about how the death penalty actually harmed them, how it actually made things more traumatic for them, how it was something that they really felt like had compounded their pain. And then also meeting people who were guilty on death row, people who did do it. And the reality is most people there are not innocent. Most people there did do something horrible. But when you go and you meet these people and you witness some of the changes and redemption possible in their lives and get to know them as people and hear about, the pain they've incurred themselves from what they've done and their desire to make amends and having to live with that, I just think the human aspect finally clicked for me. And as a person of faith, it did become something that I no longer could abide by. But again, that took years for me to get to that point, having worked in this movement.
So you talked about the victims' families, and I find that point interesting because I don't know that I've really heard much about that side of things from the anti-death penalty crowd. So usually you hear things about how the victims' families want the death penalty. Is that not the case in your experience?
It's not the case in my experience, and I would never attempt to speak for all victims' family members. That's actually a huge bone I have to pick with proponents of the death penalty, as they often elevate victims, their family members, and attempt to speak for them while not actually working alongside them or knowing them. There are victims' family members who fall on both sides of this debate, but overwhelmingly, when I have worked at state capitals, we have seen victims' family members turn out something like 36 to 1, those who want to get rid of it as opposed to those who want to keep it. So we find a vast number of people are opposed to it. Our sponsor in New Hampshire actually was a murder victim's family member twice himself. He lost both his dad and his brother in separate incidents. And so, of course, not everybody is on the same side of the aisle on this, but as a whole, in my experience, there are a lot more people who are opposed to it in that camp than who want to keep it. And they are far more active, and they dedicate their time to going and sharing their story, which is immensely hard to do. It's a very, very tough thing, but they go and I see them get on panels and speak and talk to lawmakers and stand up and give testimony and really take that on because they feel so strongly.
And what do you think when people think of the death penalty and they think of it as something where it's really only used in the most heinous of cases and it's only used after every opportunity to exonerate the person is exhausted? One thing you've described to me that I found really interesting is I would have thought in the abstract, like we talked about the abstract support for the death penalty, right? I would have thought in the abstract that it must indeed involve some sort of many off-ramps, many chances to prove your innocence, many double checks. But you've actually told me that the system works at every turn to prevent innocent people from being exonerated, right? So can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, and that's a really great question because it's another really big assumption people have that I shared, that the people who get this are the worst of the worst, right? And so often I hear people say, I support it, but only for the worst of the worst and only for people who are truly guilty. To which I reply, you know, what is the worst of the worst, first and foremost? That's quite subjective. What I think is the worst of the worst might be different than what you think. But let's even say we can agree, and let's say you harm a child, and we say this is the worst of the worst. That isn't how we decide who gets the death penalty. Instead, it's almost entirely up to the district attorney, the prosecutor. And what we see is that the vast majority of them do not pursue death penalty cases anymore. I think largely because of the expense, because they know they can actually process more cases, get more done. I think a lot of them recognize it doesn't work. And because as a whole, juries aren't going for it, even when they do pursue it. We see that new death sentences have collapsed since 2000, and that coincides with the implementation of life without parole statutes in most states. So a lot of states didn't formally have that option. Now that they do, and juries know there's a way to incapacitate somebody permanently and that they won't be an ongoing danger without killing them, they typically go for that instead. So most prosecutors aren't going for it. We see only about 2% of counties continue to bring the majority of these cases. To date, since reinstatement, all executions we've carried out have been from less than 16% of our nation's counties. So it's highly arbitrary and based almost entirely on where the location of the crime is. If you were to dig into the data of people on death rows in life without parole populations, or maybe even in the general population of prisons, and compare some of the crimes, you'd actually find cases that look almost identical, but just by luck of the draw, one person got this, one person got the other. And that's a huge problem. We saw that when the death penalty was initially overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1973, it was overturned because they found it violated the Eighth Amendment's prohibitions against cruel and unusual punishment. They didn't find that it violated the cruel component of that clause, but the unusual component, because it was so randomly applied. They said it was as unusual as being struck by lightning. And because of that, and because of the overt racial bias they found in the system, it was outlawed for about 3 or 4 years. And then states started adding mitigating factors and aggravating factors and all of these things that were supposed to be safeguards to bring it back and to ensure that it only killed people who truly did it and the worst of the worst. But we've had, you know, 4+ decades worth of data now to see how that's worked. And we see that it operates in virtually the exact same manner. And we also see that once a conviction is upheld, the state then works with every fiber of its being and every bit of muscle that it has, which is significant, to uphold that conviction. Every incentive goes towards them doing that. And I think a lot of people have this vision of the appellate process being something where they're really going in and they're combing through and saying, like, does this DNA evidence still hold up? Did we find anything new? Was this a reliable witness? That's not what's happening in the appellate process. Mostly it's more of a procedural checklist. You know, was this followed? Did we have this procedure in place? Did they have an attorney? Okay, check, 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 on to the next. And it keeps moving in that way. And instead what we find is, and this happens quite a bit every year, there's at least one or two cases in the states where they get scheduled for execution and there is significant evidence that could prove that they're innocent. And it's a real battle to try to get it tested. And sometimes that perseveres and other times it doesn't and the execution goes through.
Wow, that's really disturbing. The more you read about that, the worse it gets. But one thing I've noticed, and I've seen some people pointing this out in recent days as it relates to the case of Brandon Bernard, it does seem like some people who oppose the death penalty, I'm thinking of even Kim Kardashian in particular, and some of the social media posts you'll see, they almost seem to, people who oppose the death penalty sometimes downplay the horrific nature of the crimes. They make them people seem like that really wasn't so bad, or they skirt over the details of the horrific things that some of these people do. And do you think that that is a mistake? And is it possible to simultaneously admit fully how horrible this person's actions were, and also still argue that even a murderer can be redeemed?
Yeah, 100%. And I think that is something I've noticed as well. As somebody who works on the policy and not the cases, I do think I get the benefit of being a bit removed. And I think that oftentimes when we see people like Kim Kardashian or the attorney speaking, we have to remember that these are people who are working day in and day out with this person. They know them. It's a personal relationship to them. And I think that's why you see that sometimes end up where they are no longer talking about this in the same frame that you or I might. And I think when I have been around people within the criminal justice population as a whole, but certainly within death row populations, what you'll find is a lot of them have no desire to cover up what they did. They want to talk about it. They want to make amends. They want to seek restitution. And I don't think that that does any favors, right? Like, we need to talk about violence. That's actually a really big problem I have with the criminal justice movement at large, is on the right, I often see them skirt the issue of violence. They just want to focus on nonviolent issues, reentry, workforce development. When we're not going to address the real problems of mass incarceration, we're not going to make our community safer unless we start tackling violence and really getting into the messiness of it and figuring out, which I think we largely are doing so, what causes it? What are the triggers? How can we intervene and prevent it? And what can we do when it does occur to actually foster healing for everybody who's harmed, for the victims, for their family members, for the communities, and for the perpetrator themselves? Because there are things we could be doing to address these underlying causes that we're not doing, that I think then breed more violence, because violence can be quite cyclical in nature. So I agree with you that that's not a helpful frame of reference. And I also think that it ignores the what comes in between, right? When you do something really terrible, there does need to be accountability. There does need to be restitution. You do need to have requirements made of you. We don't need to skip from here to here. And I think that that can occur at times.
And do you think that when people are looking at these cases like Brandon Bernard, people would say things like he was only 18 years old when he was convicted, or he was just a teenager, or they would say, well, he wasn't the one that killed them. And I understand that all of that is technically correct. And I'm reading, you know, the New York Times news reports and other outlets, how they're framing the story. All of that is factually true, but it's also kind of all contributing to a narrative, not just that this person shouldn't have been killed, but they're almost trying to recast what he did and whitewash it a little bit, do you think? And so how do you, because those details do matter, it does matter that he was only 18, but how do you strike the balance between talking about those things without making it seem like you're downplaying the horrific nature of some of the crimes? Because I think when it seems like the death penalty opponents are somewhat indifferent or downplaying or whitewashing the crime, that fuels the conservative voices who the case they're making in favor of the death penalty is all emotional, right? It's all about emotional appeal and rah-rah rhetoric. And I think that really plays into their hands.
Yeah, I don't think you're wrong at all. And I think the solution is to separate the two things. And I want to backtrack a little bit, but I remember when I used to be a proponent of the death penalty, I could not stand that opponents were always talking about the traumatic backgrounds of the people that were facing death. You know, it was always on and on and on about their background being so terrible. And I had that sort of emotional reaction of as well that many other people have of like, well, you care more about the person who hurt somebody than you do about the person who got hurt. And it really turned me off. And I didn't understand why they were constantly doing that. Now that I'm like deep into the weeds of this policy, I have a better understanding of why that's the case. But I think that we need to talk about these things separately. I think we need to talk about the case, talk about the reasons that it should still not go through, which again, I do think revolve around the practicality measures of how the death penalty is applied. But then separately, I think we need to have conversations about some of these things that they're trying to get to when they say things like that. And so it does matter that a person is 18. As we learn more and more about the brain and as we study criminality as a whole, you see criminality virtually drop off after the age of 25. Why is that? Because your cognitive functions are fully formed. Your prefrontal cortex is not fully developed until you're 25. And so your way of weighing risk, of weighing repercussions, your impulsivity, there are all kinds of actual scientific factors behind why we should treat people who commit violence or crime under age 25 a bit differently than people we treat over 25. Now, that's not saying that we should not hold them accountable, that there should be no repercussions. It's just acknowledging that they are slightly less culpable. They aren't operating with the same set of a fully formed brain as the rest of us at that point. We also need to take that data and then think through what can we do to prevent and intervene in early age criminality, because there's a lot we could be doing. We could take that and apply it to things that would actually get involved, identify early on risk factors, and then try to pursue and move people in a different direction. I think we're largely not doing many of those things because we're wasting so much money being punitive and so much of our resources and attention on being punitive after violence occurs, instead of saying, what can we do to prevent it in the first place? So it's important to understand why it matters that he was 18, but I don't think the time to bring that up is while we're having discussions around the case itself and around the loss of life. I think that that can come across a bit callous. Secondarily, it is important to understand why the traumatic backgrounds of people matter. It's important to understand how that can play into cyclical natures of violence. And that's not to say that everybody who's harmed or has a traumatic event occur to them will become violent. It's just to say they're at heightened risk. It also changes the brain functions. It changes the prefrontal cortex. We can actually look at scans of people's brains and see that when they are beat up, when they are raped, when they are molested, when they are beaten, it changes how their brain functions. And it also, I think, desensitizes you to violence. There's something that happens to your brain when you witness death, when you see a body. Some of these things are really scarring and have lasting impacts. And again, there are tests like the ACE measurement test, adverse childhood effects test, that we could be giving to people early on. We could be identifying people who are at higher risk, who are incurring some of these things, and start trying to intervene, get them help, get them healing before the cycle repeats itself. And that's something we're not doing. So these are conversations we need to have. But when people try to have them all at once in a short clip for an article and a quick statement, it doesn't translate very well.
Yeah. And another topic that you had mentioned to me the other day when we were talking about this was that actually I would have assumed, right, because this is not my issue and I don't know a ton about it, I would have assumed that we don't execute people that are special needs, that have disabilities, right? I would have assumed that that was unconstitutional or that even proponents wouldn't want the law to set up that way. But you explained that often that is just viewed as a technicality and we do in fact execute some people with special needs. So can you explain how that happens and to what extent that's actually a thing? And how do they get away with that? Because that's so manifestly, I think, objectionable.
Yeah, and it is unconstitutional, to be fair, but only in the early 2000s. So in 2002 and in 2005, we had two separate Supreme Court decisions, one that said it was not constitutional to execute someone under the age of 18. The second said it's not legal to execute someone with an intellectual disability. But because these were decisions that came about through the U.S. Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court does not set policy. They weigh in on policy. What is constitutional? What is not? And so when they said these things are not constitutional, what that does and what that always does in these circumstances is basically open up the gate for states to set their own policy to regulate after that. So when they said it's not constitutional to execute someone with an intellectual disability, they weren't able to come in and actually write the code for how that would be determined in the states or how that would be what those protocols would be for determining who had an intellectual disability, what the checks and balances would be to ensure that we weren't executing people with intellectual disabilities. So what we saw was sort of an ad hoc response by states. Some came in and right away put in statutes. Some drug their heels. Texas, I think just this year, passed their bill to actually implement their standards. They didn't previously have any, and they kept getting away with that, getting away with that, getting away with that. But basically, most of them determined that they would use a simple IQ test. And so they would say, if your IQ is 60 or beneath, then you have an intellectual disability and we're not going to execute you. But it's not a very comprehensive system across the board. And some states have made that bar higher than others. So it's very much just sort of random whose statute's better than the others. And we definitely see people fall through the cracks. We did not see a comprehensive system where they would go back through people who had already been sentenced to death row at that point and say, did they have an intellectual disability? Did they not? Is this still appropriate? Is it not? So those battles are largely fought through the appellate process now. And we continually see them brought up. And to be frank, it's typically the state courts, the state Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court that continue to not intervene. Even when these claims are brought, they're not doing a very good job at upholding their own statutes. So we every year see people who are executed who definitely have intellectual disabilities.
So from the prosecutor perspective, or what is motivating these people to try to get a death penalty conviction or maintain one instead of just putting people away for life in prison? Like, what is their rationale, or why is that something they fight so hard for?
Well, again, just to be clear, most of them don't. Most of them don't pursue it. Most of them don't show up at the state capitals to fight to keep it. It's a very small percentage of them. But the ones who do tend to pursue death penalty cases over and over and over. And, I hate to be unkind here, but to be honest, a death penalty case brings somebody a lot of media attention. It's in the news. It's in the headlines. It gets a ton of attention. It's prestigious when you get that kind of conviction. It definitely elevates somebody's career. And a lot of these people who run for district attorney have higher goals. You typically see someone follow a very typical pathway as a district attorney where they'll be in that office for a while, and then they might run for attorney general, and then they might run for governor, and then they might run for senator. We've seen people like Senator Josh Hawley, Senator Kamala Harris, all have this background. It's a pretty typical pathway way that we see them follow. So I think there's political power, there's recognition. And I think that as a whole, they get a big old slap on the back, and you're the defender of the community and you're keeping us safe. And it's all just a very emotional knee-jerk kind of system. But I can't think of any other reason they would continue to do this again. It means that they don't get to pursue as many cases. I think it makes their communities less safe. They waste vast amounts of money. It's startling the amount of money they spend and how much the other counties in the state have to fund those particular counties that are more aggressive in it. We hear victim family members, again, always speaking out against it. I mean, quite frequently you hear them very adamant against it, and they're not listened to by the prosecutors. They're not listened to by the proponents. In Colorado this year, we had a coalition of about 36 murder victims family members who came up. They held a press conference. They were trying to meet with lawmakers. Most of the lawmakers who were voting against us would not sit down and speak with them. One of them in particular, who was a former police officer himself, a state senator, got on the floor and gave this very impassioned speech about how this was for the victim's family members. He wouldn't sit down and talk with the victim's family members. He left the room when the victim's family members got up to give testimony about how this harmed them. And so it's this very, very sick system when you really sit back and watch it that just feels quite gross. But there are a small number of prosecutors that are very active in keeping it, and their associations are typically very active in keeping it. And they lobby on our dollars, taxpayer-funded lobbying, to come up and work against us.
So what is the state of play, right? Because there is this broken system. But in terms of public opinion and the movement to, one, among Democrats versus Republicans, conservatives versus liberals, but two, also the population at large, what direction is public opinion trending, and what kind of big picture trends in terms of policy changes have we seen and do you expect going forward?
Well, we're definitely winning the war. We lose some battles from time to time, namely, with executions. That's this difficult, especially when you see them really gearing up like they have at the federal level. But across the country, we've been winning for the past 20 years on this. I mentioned new death sentences have collapsed. Executions have also collapsed. We've had less than 30 for the past 5-6 years. Only about 7 or 8 states still carrying out those executions. We've had 22 states repeal legislatively. 3 others have moratoriums in place. So 25 states with active systems. Of those, over a third haven't had an execution in a decade or more. So it's really, really diminishing. Public opinion polls show that about 50%+ of people say that the death penalty is not applied fairly. We've seen a big shift in the number of people, both conservatives and Democrats, who support it over the past couple of years, especially since 2000, which was sort of the height of the popularity of it. But I think even more so than polls, if you really want to see what's happening, if you watch the state legislatures, it's really incredible. We've had 11 states in the past year and a half that have had Republican sponsors sponsored bills to repeal the death penalty. About 56 Republican lawmakers signed on as sponsors to those bills, hundreds of others voting in favor of them. We've passed death penalty repeal in a state for each of the past 2 years. Last year was New Hampshire, where we actually overrode a Republican governor's veto with significant Republican support. So that's a really big deal, very difficult to override a veto. And then this year in Colorado, we also were able to pass it right before the shutdown started, again, with significant Republican support. Wouldn't have happened in either of those two states had Republicans not made up the difference. So I think there's this perception that all Democrats are against it. That's not quite true. I never make assumptions. They are a little bit more favorable, but as a whole, we just see both parties, both sets of people moving against it, because I just think as we move further into the age of information, all of the data is on our side. All the arguments are on our side. There's no excuse for the system. It just doesn't work. And so as a whole, we don't see people cling to it. We certainly don't see voters cling to it. It's not something that they really tend to vote on or get animated about or even show up at the Capitol on, unless they're impacted, right? Unless they're exonerees, unless they're murder victims, family members, and then we see them showing up trying to get rid of it. But It does feel like things are moving in our direction. Wyoming, very red state. It fell only 4 votes shy of repeal last year. They didn't have a bill this year because they had a budgetary session. So you can't really get bills introduced that aren't specific budgetary bills. But I think they'll be back next year. We do anticipate it could pass there. We're waiting to see what's going to happen with state legislative sessions because of COVID. Some are talking about doing Zoom sessions, which would be my own personal hell. Some are talking about delaying. So we'll have to see. There's really incredible movement happening in Ohio right now, very red state, but we've got significant statewide support, former governors, former attorneys general, former congressmen, and many active present lawmakers as well, all who are hoping to see this bill pass there in the next year or two. So I think that could be achieved realistically in the next year or two. And then there's a lot of states in the wings. Kentucky's got potential, North Carolina, Pennsylvania. There's some movement happening in Indiana, Utah, Louisiana. All of these are red states that are, or at least purple states that are really making a lot of gains and movement. So I think we're in the home stretch. The death penalty will go away. We're the last Western country still using it at all and have been for many, many years. So I think it's a question of if and not when.
Well, I think that's a good note to kind of wrap up the somber and morose talk. So we'll shift directly from the death penalty and your personal hell of Zoom sessions, which sound brutal. Two, you are going to be the first one that gets to give a second hot food take on the show. And that's a good opportunity because I know that you felt you didn't really bring your best, your most controversial last time. So now is your second chance to redeem yourself for the listeners. Hit us with your hot food take.
Thank you. I have thought about this a lot. Every time I go to eat this one food, I think about it. I'm like, I should have said this because not liking onions, that's not really controversial. A lot of people hate onions. And so my next one's good. I stand strongly by this, but I love to drink pickle juice. Pickle juice is delicious. It should be sold on its own. I think it is sold on its own as like an alcohol mixer, but that's not what I want. I want one specific brand. I want Heinz dill pickles, which are the best dill pickles in the entire world. And they're quite a hot commodity in the South. They're not that easy to find. I want their pickle juice bottled in like shot form. It's great. It's hydrating. It's a great drink. So that's my controversial food take. I think I upped the ante this time.
All right. It's definitely more controversial, though I like pickles, so it doesn't sound half bad to me. But that is it for today, everybody. So if you like the show, make sure that you are subscribed on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. And Hannah, thanks so much for coming on. It's great to have you back.
Thanks for having me back, Brad.
You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.